Welcome back to Orale Boa Heights, coming at you from Picaresca Coffee Bar here in Boa Heights, early in the morning. I can now say this is the earliest podcast interview I've had in all my years of doing this. So you win that title, sir.
I'm glad to wear it.
So I'm here today with the one and only Francisco Escamilla, Bus Stop Prophet. Say what's up to the folks.
What's up, family? How you doing? Good morning. It's early. It's early. Me and Eric are early
birds
today.
Enjoying the... Well, no, you got tea. I got coffee.
Yeah, I got a chai tea. I got to say, it's pleasant. I'm going to use that word. It's pleasant. It's enjoyable.
Nice.
The spot is really cool, man. I didn't know it was here. I mean, I knew the mini mall was here, but this was quite a surprise.
Apparently, you have history with this mini mall.
Yeah, well, not. I mean, I didn't own a store here or anything, but I grew up right behind in the Wivenwood Gardens.
Yeah.
So I lived there for a good 22 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my grandfather lived there a lot longer than that, and we moved in with
no
him.
No way.
Yeah, so we had about seven of us in one room and my grandpa in the other.
Of course. That's how we do. That's we save rent on multi-generational housing.
Yeah, that's true.
But, dude, thanks again for coming through. I know, it's not easy working around your schedule. You know, we're all busy. Things are picking up again with, like, COVID easing down. So really appreciate you making the time to come through.
No, thank you, brother. I appreciate the invitation. I was really excited when you hit me up in Instagram. I get excited at messages, bro. Like, I really do, especially coming out of this pandemic where people were really going in, you know, they were introverted and they were spending time with themselves and really looking at themselves in their mirror. And
I was.
I'm used to doing that all the time anyway. Like, that's kind of the work that I do on myself. Exactly. So it was like, I can do that and still be like, hey, what's going on? What are we going to do? And people were just... you know, not responding. So when I get a message, I'm the same way when I get mail, though, bro. When like,
it's a bill.
Exactly.
That's dope. Well, I know you're one of the few folks I know that like carry the geek nerd flag proudly, you know, out and about. What are some of your favorite shows right now?
Ooh, good question. I wish I would have prepared for that question. I'm watching the last season of The Last Kingdom right now.
All right.
I kind of dig. I know it's not exactly like sci-fi fantasy nerd, but it's kind of like
it's
historical
still
fantasy
realm.
Nerd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I dig the Vikings, man. I mean, did some horrible things, but like the culture, and the folklore is really.
It's
really,
not like those Brits had it coming.
Yeah, but they also I like the storytelling on the show because it's not American.
Oh, so yeah.
You'll get...
I think they're filming New Zealand, like in Australia, like out there, because it's a lot... I mean, that's where they filmed a lot, historically, a lot of shows, like Lord of the Rings, Xena.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, just the narrative, like, practice of it, because it's very much... I think it's, like, a Denmark production, I think.
All right.
So it's and they tell stories a lot differently. So you'll get...
They do.
We're used to, like, a certain introduction of a character and then their story plot going out throughout the entire story. Mm. And these, you'll get introduced to somebody and you're like, ooh, they're going to be important. And then they'll, like, die in the next episode. You're like, what happened? But it's kind of cool and refreshing. So I'm enjoying that. But the last real big shows that I enjoyed, Lovecraft Country...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that blew me away. I watched that about 3 times.
It's like they didn't get picked up again.
Yeah.
I know that the show had issues with a lot of things, understandably, right? When you're trying to put on a lot of complicated issues and balance all of that on a mainstream TV show, it's not easy. But I still enjoyed it, despite a lot of like those shortcomings that people were pointing out.
Yeah, I think also like the creator had said they weren't sure if they wanted to do a season two. Like, if the story made sense. Like, I mean, maybe the production or the distribution company was like, well, we're not going to let him get up on us. Like, we're going to say we canceled it. But I think it was like, if the story makes sense, you know, I'll tell another one. But I hope that was the case. And I hope, like, they changed their mind down the line. Because, yeah, it was phenomenal.
Hell yeah. If you like that show, you should keep an eye out for Bitterroot. So it's a comic book. It's really a fucking dope comic book. I've been following it. It's basically taking the idea of Ghostbusters in the Harlem Renaissance. And Regina King already picked it up to, like, turn it into a movie.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, that's in my stack, bro.
Yeah.
I think I have Bitterroot. I have the first graphic novel in my stack of To Get To
books. It's really good. It's really good. Now. It's one of my favorite writers, yeah. Yeah, let's get into it, dude. I know you've been writing, being a poet for a long time, being a mentor, holding a lot of space for folks, but like you mentioned, you grew up in Wyvernwood. When was that?
I grew up in Wyvernwood when it was about in the 80s. I think it was in the 80s that we moved here. We originally, my father was a truck driver, and we were living in Alhambra originally. Mm. The first place we got. Like, he grew up in the Hazard Projects. I'm forgetting the name.
Oh,
right,
shit.
Now. What's the name of the project? Someone over there, over the hill.
Ramona
Gardens. Yeah. He grew up in Ramona Gardens. My grandma lived there for multiple years, you know, and he started making he made some money, and I think they got a place in Alhambra, but my dad also he was sick. He had a drug problem, you know, so he very quickly got lost in that, and we had to, you know, find somewhere to go, and so my mother's father lived in Wyvernwood. And so we moved in there when I was about 3, I think.
Okay, we were super young.
Yeah, super young. And I remember, it was exciting, you know. You don't know what's happening. You're going
somewhere. At that
age,
yeah.
Somewhere new. You don't know. It's like, wow, look at all these places. Look at all these people next to each other. And
you were there with, like, cousins and other family?
No, I have 4 brothers and sisters, so we're 5 in total. So we were there with and then my mom and my dad, and we were all in one room. And my grandfather was in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
My grandpa was cool, man. I mean, he was, he also struggled with some stuff. He was an alcoholic, you know. He was, he worked for the mail industry for quite a few years. He was a truck driver as well.
Mm-hmm.
And veteran from Korean War.
Shit.
And, yeah, he was a paratrooper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he told us, like, exaggerated. He said he jumped from, like, a plane, like, 300 times, but, you know. I also remember the not so exaggerated moments, you know, when he would have nightmares and
PTSD.
Yeah,
wow.
And we'd be in the next room, you know, and we'd hear these things. But he always made things kind of magical. He used to come into our room like in the morning, and he would tell us at night that he was like Superman, right? He's like, you guys get ready to go to bed, because when you sleep, I'm gonna pick you up and we're gonna fly, and we're gonna fly past the moon. And then he'd come up in the morning and he'd be like, hey, you remember? Do you remember when we flew? Did you touch the moon? Remember? And I'll be like, yeah, I remember. My brother's like, I don't remember any of this stuff. But yeah, we all grew up in that apartment on Glen Avenue, and you learn very quickly, like the neighborhood and the situation and the culture that you live in. You know, that is thrusted upon you. I remember I learned the hard way. Like, I was riding my bike at a BMX, and I was riding it around the neighborhood, and then I left it on my porch to go run the restroom, and I never saw that bike
again. Oh, man. Yeah. That's a sucky feeling, losing your first bike as a kid.
It is. And, I mean, at that time, too, like, in Wyvernwood, like, there were, like, 7, 8 different gangs, because it's such a big, like,
it is.
Piece of
if
land.
You've never been there, it's a big community. But, it's in a super small area of the neighborhood, like its own pocket.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not enclosed. It doesn't have any fences, but it's very much enclosed. Like, you didn't go in there if you didn't live there.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to know which blocks to go down and, you know, where not to, which alleys to walk through. And you know, we used to get into a lot of trouble there. I remember, like, walking down this street going to school, which I had to go through about 7 or 8 gang neighborhoods to go to school, and there would be youngsters being prompted by the older, you know, gangsters, and they'd be, like, told to hit us up, right? They were training them, you know? So those
are, like, they're doing it, and then they're in the back watching.
Exactly.
Oh,
you
shit.
Know, like, are you doing it right? Were you standing right? You know, but...
Nah, little homie, you got to point your shoe that way.
Yeah, your toes should not be pointed forward. They gotta be like, yeah, you know, and they size you up in that process, you know, and they...
I remember all that shit.
I mean, it's hard not to. Like, even if you were not involved with the gang culture, you were involved with the gang culture because it's surrounding you, so you have to know the rules, the guidelines, you know, the agreements, the unspoken agreements. And so, like, navigating that took, you know, you have to learn real quick to navigate that or get lost in that.
You know, the ones that I still remember that are kind of triggering are when people ask you about your clothes, especially your shoes, right? Back then, it's like, what size are them shoes?
Yeah, it's really funny because I do that to my students.
Oh, shit.
That's why I tell them, you know, if they're wearing a nice sweater or the shoe, hey, what size is that hoodie, homie? And they really think about it. Oh, I said, anytime anybody asks you that question, you say my size. Or else they're going to take it, you know? And they laugh, but I'm like, no, this is real. Like, this happened. Like, you get your sweater took, you get your pants took.
Or, like, if you're really, you know, trying to put it out there, you're like, your size.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, you know, you can have it. Don't hit me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it was a rough time, and it was beautiful too. I made a lot of friends, but you know, and my mom is just this really big-hearted person. So she ended up being sort of mentor to a lot of these little gang members
that takes a village.
Exactly. Like, you know, their parents didn't know what to do, and she kind of opened up our doors. So there was always people in our apartment, you know, someone sleeping on the couch, like that got kicked out of their house or that. And I mean, I don't think she knew exactly what she was doing, like in the mentorship process, but a lot of these people found mentorship.
But knowing that somebody needed that help, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And her kindness. So that at least in our neighborhood, got us some leeway, right? Like now I was Sylvia's son, so they wouldn't mess with me.
That's showing respect, yeah.
Yeah, it was just necessary for her. Like, she wasn't doing it to build any sort of respect, but she did it because she respected life, you know, and they respected that, you know. So at least the first few blocks, you know, on the way to school were safe for a while, you know. And then you'd hit the other neighborhoods, and same thing, they try to shake you down, or, you know, you have to, you know, fight to get to school sometimes. Yeah. Couldn't be wearing any kind of gold chain or
nothing flashy, nothing overtly in. Like the wrong colors or something. I was just talking to the homie about this, like things got so convoluted that like you could be wearing the wrong shoes and you're like, why are you wearing those shoes?
Yeah,
like those are British Knights, those are blood killers, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you had, I remember my mom's one rule was I couldn't have Nike Cortez.
Yeah,
I could, you know, later on, like, you know, I got involved with gangs a little later on in my life, but like for some reason that was her thing. That was like, nope, you can't put these on.
That's like what makes it official.
Yeah, you can crease down, you know, your Dickies. You can wear the white shirt. You know, you can wear the high socks, but you cannot wear Nike Cortez. And
that's a trip. How that's that, you know, right? We grew up with that as that was an understanding, and that was a cultural marker of gangs and violence and a lot of stuff. And now it's just Nike has totally gone with it and be like, yeah, let me sell you this cholo culture idea, right? This cholo fit.
Yeah, I remember they were like $25-$30 for a pair of clothes.
Oh yeah.
And now it's like $120.
Yeah, dude, I have the special Dia de los Muertos one.
Oh really? Man,
no shame.
You gotta pre-order that 2 years in advance. Did you have to show your Chicano card to get the discount?
I wish.
Yeah, I still want to. They're not comfortable, you know.
Yeah, if you have, depending on your feet and how you walk. Yeah.
Later, the metaphor of it kind of messed with me too, right? That they were Cortez. Mm. And Cortez has always oppressed our people, you know.
Dude, that shit blew my mind when I made that connection, right? Cortez.
It didn't connect until the first time you hear about, you know, a history of
Hernando Cortez and all that shit.
And it's like, yeah, maybe I don't want to wear those, you know. Maybe it is. A metaphor trying to keep me down, you know? And that's just, you know, that's more than just me trying to rationalize, you know, that I can't have them. But yeah, man, I you know, one of the most important things in Wyvernwood for me and what helped me really survive at that time was, like, I was this kid with this really big heart and really big imagination. And Wyvernwood, the different type of hood it is because it has trees. So it looks like a big park.
There's a lot of lawns.
A lot of trees, like a lot of little spaces to hide and play and imagine, you know. And it's completely different from like the Estrada Courts, which is like right next to it and is a proper, for lack of a better word, proper project.
I would say it's a little bit more brutal because it's a lot of hard cement.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of flat walls, a lot of like straight lines, right? Not leaving anything to the imagination. It's just like, you're here, and this is what you're supposed to do. Yeah. But then the fucking murals break all that up.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, they made it a garden.
Yeah.
Those murals, you know, because they try. Like, you go in there, and you're right. It's straight lines. It's concrete. I mean, it's, like I said, it's, for lack of a better term, proper. It's a proper
government
project.
Housing. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure that, I mean, that it feels like a prison, you know? And so to be in Wyvernwood and to be amongst these different trees, it just made it different for me because I always had this big imagination. So, like, even though it was dangerous and even though, like, it felt like, you know, anything could happen and not usually a good thing at any moment, it also felt like there was like, a power in it, like a hope. Right, I used to imagine that I was like a knight, right? Or you could imagine that you were like a superhero, or like you were in this enchanted forest, yeah, walking around, and it really made the difference for me, for my heart, for my imagination. It helped me move through a lot growing up there.
That says a lot, man, because I feel that, right? You know, we're having very similar experiences growing up in different communities, but a lot of systemic issues with the same issues of poverty. Housing insecurity, food insecurity, violence, and all that stuff. But yeah, the difference maker was that you had some actual green space that allowed you to engage with your imagination and keep it going.
Yeah, most definitely. And nature is the biggest mentor. And, you know, we're not taught that. That's taken away from us, you know.
It's not prioritized.
No. And culturally, historically, we've always known this, you know. Like, our people always need to put our feet in the dirt, you know. We recognize the relationship and the metaphor in, like, witnessing nature and being in nature and how it holds us, you know? But that was never given to us or explained to us or offered to us as a form of healing.
No.
You know? Yeah. So we ignore it or we take it for granted.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely something, you know, we come back to in our own space when we're like, I need to reconnect with that. With you, you know, being in Wyvernwood for, you know, a good chunk of your adolescence, and you mentioned this already. I think I kind of already want to know the answer, but right, I want to hear from you. Is when did that transition started to bleed over? Right, that you were, you know, you were a neighborhood kid. You were there. You weren't really in the scene. But then, you know, eventually, I think you just got old enough, and I think that was like our, like, did you feel like that was like inevitable that you were going to become part of like a gang life and like everything that was around you?
I think part of me always knew that I wanted to be part of a community. Of course, I couldn't word it like that at that time, but I, you know, you see gangs and they're sort of celebrities, yeah. You know, they have their names on the walls.
So, I mean, for one reason or another, they do fulfill that feeling of like brotherhood and family when it's not somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And so like it was very glamorized, the culture. And also, you were protected, you know, and how it happened for me wasn't like I didn't step into a specific gang. I was in middle school and I was hanging out with a bunch of people that were cool and also like looking for something similar and not knowing.
Okay.
And then we just started hanging out more and more, and more people started hanging out. And then I had a friend Omar who I went to elementary school with. He was hanging out. So this was at Stevenson. We were in middle school now. So, like, seventh grade was really hard for me. I couldn't connect. I was really fearful going into this new environment.
A lot of transitioning. Yeah,
a lot. And at the same time.
Oh, wait, because that was back then when you were in elementary school up to, like, sixth grade.
Yeah. So I mean, I've always had a tough time with school. And I think a part of that, like, I'm still dealing with my father's problem because he's either absent, like he's locked up, and, you know, and I'm dealing with sort of that trauma, or he was present and terrorizing us because of his drug problem, you know. So this is all going on at the same time. All these new transitions are happening. So there's all kinds of abandonment stuff in me. There's all kinds of just fear of change
going through it.
Yeah, because change has never, up to this point, has never been good. And so like it was always hard for me. Like kindergarten was hard for me, and then eventually every time I started a new school was kind of hard for me. Yeah. So like when I got to middle school, I was this nerdy kid, you know, loved, you know, rap and punk rock and
very different in this hood.
yeah. And so that happened where he started gathering with these dudes, and then I ran into my friend Omar, who was hanging out with his clique in the PE area. And Omar looked like a warrior, bro. Like, that dude's like
in middle school.
Yeah, he's been his blood, like they're Yaki, right?
Oh,
they got
shit.
That Yaki blood. So like they came out looking like gangsters, right? They came out like seriously, bro. Like I remember, like he just has his face, you know. Like,
I can see that.
And so we talked one day. We met up, and he's like, "Yo, bro, you got this, you know, this crew, and we got this crew. Like, let's just bring it together."
Voltron.
Yeah, exactly. So we did, and very, very quickly, you know, it started shifting into that kind of practice, that kind of gang life, you know, where we were like, oh, well, this is our school, and like, you know, we would fight with other crews at the spot. Mm. We didn't have a block, right? Like, our stuff was mainly at school. Other people would like pay tribute to us because we were like the main crew, you know. So at one point, they wanted to arrest me early on for like organized crime.
Dang.
Yeah, me and Omar got pulled in ninth grade.
Like, y'all was the ringleaders in this.
Exactly, you know, and we didn't really do much. We didn't really do that. Like, people were doing stuff, and they would be like, "Yo, we want to do this stuff," but it was never our. We never organized all of that, you know. But the school police really quickly was like, "Yo, the ringleaders, we cut the head off the chicken."
I mean, looking from the outside in, they can probably easily see who are all these little fools looking up to, right? Who's, yeah, like, leading the charge.
Yeah, so that was sort of the experience without going too... I mean, I could tell you stories, right? But yeah, that's kind of how we stepped into that.
Yeah, I think I know you've reflected on that, right? That aspect, that specific aspect that you just mentioned, that you got singled out. Obviously for all the wrong reasons, but at the same time singled out because you, not just you, but other people saw leadership skills, right? Qualities in you.
Yeah.
And what was it, where was it for you where you kind of like, for yourself, you realized that was how other people were seeing you?
I mean, it was when I was a little older. Like, I always knew I always felt I had really good communication skills, really good people skills. But teachers always put me down for it.
Mm.
So, I mean, there was a few teachers that stood out amongst all these other ones, but most teachers that I experienced didn't get in to really help youth. They got in to try to teach a subject and get a check.
So, I've been through that, yeah.
I think most of us have. I think most people in the LAUSD have to experience
it. I know that. I got funneled through, like, where you're just like, I'm just going to pass you, you can get out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I got told multiple times that I was going to end up in Pelican Bay.
Like,
yeah, I was like a 14, 15
not
year
even
old
LA County.
No.
Like, straight to Pelican Bay.
Straight to Pelican Bay.
And I shoe program.
Exactly. And I never did anything. I didn't do anything but be myself, right?
God damn.
So I would talk like, students would listen to me more than they would listen to the teachers. And we'd be in there. I mean, I was joking, you know. I was trying to get attention. I was trying to figure myself out and understand myself.
Getting out your wiggles, yeah.
Yeah, and teachers didn't know how to deal with that or how to invite that, right? How to recognize that it was leadership skills and say, hey, let me guide you. Let me offer you these
Point
different
you
things to
in
do
the
with
right
this.
Direction, yeah.
Yeah, so there was a lot of rebellion. There was a lot of resistance in me where I was like, okay, well, like, if you're telling me I'm going to end up in prison, I'm going to resist, but I'm also kind of believing you because you're the adult in the room, right? And so, like, that continued on for a while until Omar's... So Omar had an older brother named Danny. He was in high school already, and another dude, Yaki bros, straight warrior face. But he was also brilliant. He was brilliant. He was an amazing artist. He was an amazing student. So was Omar. But he had just got into college. He was going to go to college. And they had went to the dam. Was it Santa Fe Dam?
Yeah.
Santa Fe Dam. And all his cousins, his families were from a particular gang. And when they got there, it was like 20, 30 heads from another gang there.
Oh, shit.
And at first it was all good. They were like... you know, they were like, oh, cool. You know, they did their thing. Where you from? Where you from? And then eventually people started drinking. and Danny ended up getting murdered.
Damn.
That day, you know, and when that happened, it flipped the script for me, because I knew Danny as this sweet, like, amazing person that had an amazing future ahead of him, and it was stolen, from this lifestyle that I was participating in.
Yeah.
You know, and it was stolen from other people who had these leadership skills that didn't know what to do with them. So it flipped it for me. You know, after we buried him, I had to step away and I had to lose a lot of friends. You know, I broke a lot of hearts of my homeboys and my my brothers who trusted me and looked towards me. But I was like, what I have here is a gift, and I'm using this gift for the wrong reason. You know, I should be inviting people. I should be building community. So I stepped away, and I started spending a lot of time with myself. And in that process, I started stepping out the neighborhood, which was kind of dangerous, right? But I was like, what's out there? What else is out there in this world?
Just beyond the block.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I started jumping on buses. Excuse me. I started jumping on buses and...
Oh, this was back when it was Rough, Tough, and Dangerous.
Oh, yeah, when it was RTD, remember? Like, it wasn't even the MTA yet. But I was trusting. I was like, look, I got to follow this. And I was just going to different neighborhoods, you know, witnessing different things. And I had always written through this process, right?
All right.
Like, I didn't call it poetry at the time, what I was doing. I called it shit, you know, because, you know, you hear poetry is Shakespeare, and you hear poetry as Whitman, like when you're in school.
You hear a lot of different things, yeah.
And all of that stuff never sounded like what I was doing. So when I would share this stuff with my homeboys, I would call it shit. So you want to hear some shit I wrote, you know? And so I would write all the time. And so I was writing along this bus and on these bus trips, and what I witnessed, who I would talk to.
Mm.
And it eventually led to... to the bus stop prophet, you know, being born, you know, like, so on this one specific trip, man, I remember I was sitting on this bus stop and there was this woman sitting next to me, and I turned to her and I smiled, and she got really uncomfortable and she kind of tightened up and scoot away from me. And I remember it breaking my heart, because I didn't understand why that had to happen at the time. I was like, I'm not asking for anything. I'm just offering you this gesture of friendship and love, you know? And now I know, right? I mean, now I at least understand a little more how challenging that must have been for a woman. You know, I'm still looking a little thuggish, but even just in our culture, how hard it is for a woman.
Public transportation is not a safe space for anyone that isn't male presenting.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I stood on that for a couple of weeks, bro. I was just devastated and heartbroken and angry. Angry that we couldn't share this moment with each other and not expect anything. And so the next time that I was on a bus stop was a couple of weeks later, and it was right there by the Union Station, I remember.
Mm.
And there was four other people on this bus stop. There was this older woman, this man looked like he was going to work, and these two, like, sort of youngsters.
Okay.
And I was sitting there, and no one was talking to each other, and a fire was building in me, because I don't get this. Like, we are all individuals with hopes and dreams and thoughts and ideas of who we want to be in the world, and we can't even say hi or talk to each other. So I remember that fire building to a point where I couldn't stand it anymore, and I thought I was going to blow up. And I stood up, and I started reciting something that I wrote at the top of my lungs, right? And at first, they all looked at me, and there was a little fear, right? Like, I mean, you know what happens when you see someone yelling. We see that often, you know? On the street corners. But then that fear subsided, and I could actually see them listen. And in that process, I'm still, like, on fire, still feeling incredibly vulnerable in this moment, you know, and asking myself, what are you doing? You know, what is the point of this? You're just yelling your words into the air and expecting people to listen. But I was like, no, I trusted it. something's here, you know? And so I finished the poem. I sat down, and I was on fire still, and it was that fire of being broken open and vulnerable, and I didn't know what was going to happen next. And then the woman, she turned to me, and she said, "Mijo, did you write that?" And I said, "Yeah, I wrote that, you know?" And she's like, "I really like this, and I really like when you said this." And then the man next to her is like, "Yeah, I like this part of what you said." And then the other guy started talking with us too, and we all had a conversation.
And it
changed my life, you know? It made me recognize and realize that something on that bus stop had to die for this to be born, right? That we all have this ability and capability to connect once we step past the mask, once we step past the fear, right? And we're brave enough to, like, see each other. So I started doing it everywhere, Eric. Like, I started...
The dam's open.
Yep, it was just like, okay, we're going to keep doing this. So more bus stops, taco shops or taco carts. Laundromats. It would be great because I'd be, like, washing my chonies and then, like, saying a poem, you know? And people... Giving them all that I was, you know, and everything, and they didn't even ask for it, but it happened. You know, there was a bridge there that was created. And then eventually, it led to me, I was on this other bus stop, you know, a few months later, and it was over there on Wabash? I think it was on Wabash. And it was one of those buses that's, you know, they're supposed to get there every 15 minutes.
Oh, like the Dash or like the Mini, the ones with the shorter routes?
No, it was still an MT, it was still RTD bus, but it didn't have a sign.
All right.
Right? So, like, it's one that you know that's there, but if the bus driver doesn't remember, then he'll miss it. So I'm sitting there, and I'm there for, like, 2 hours with this old man.
Oh, shit.
Like, and we're talking politics, and we're talking, like, magic and, you know, and history and at some point, I turned to him, I'm like, "Hey, can I share something that I wrote with you?" And he said, "Sure."
You want to hear some shit?
Yeah, hear some shit. And so I did this poem, and he looked at me for a few seconds, quiet, and then he just said, "You're the bus stop prophet." And I was like, "Okay, cool. Like, then I guess that's what I'm gonna wear that too."
Hey. You know?
And yeah, so that all came from me deciding that, you know, that there was a responsibility with the gift that I had, you know, and I no longer wanted to see my people die.
Mm.
I no wanted to see young people get lost in the shuffle. So in order to do that, I had to not only step into my gift, but to be a mirror, you know, and reflect their gifts to them.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Dude, that is such a dope origin story.
Thank you.
And for you, I was, you know, you had this path now that you were on. When was it that you started making the jump to going to, like you said, you started getting out of the hood and you started going to other communities, but when was it when you started going to open mic spaces, right? And these creative spaces where community was being held for folks to come and share this space with that intention of, like, I'm a poet, I'm a writer, or I just want to share something with y'all.
Yeah, so I didn't know what an open mic was, you know. I think there was a few happening in our neighborhood, but there were so few and far between, like that if you didn't know or you didn't know the people that were there.
Know.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people here, so you don't.
Before social media, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, as I would ride these buses, I would hear about certain things, and finally, I heard about an open mic. My cousin, who also grew up here, he's not my real cousin, but we were neighbors for so long that now we just family, you know. And you know, we would go out. He's an artist. He's a musician. And we would go out and do stuff. And then we started hearing about these different open mics. So at first, I would just jump off the bus, right, and like go to a cafe, and I found this one open mic, and I remember being the first person there, right, and I signed my name, and the first person there, and then. Everyone else ended up coming, like, maybe half hour later, and I was the last person to be called up, right? And I was like, oh, this is like a, you know, again, who you know type of thing. And I was like, if I was weaker, you know, if I wasn't so strong in heart, like, this would definitely deter me from ever doing this again, you know? So I was like, okay, I have to, now that I know these things are real, like this was a couple years in, right? So when I started doing the bus stop profit story that I just told you was kind of like when I was 18, 19. Mm. And in my 20s, I started really experiencing open mics, right? So when I did that, I found that one and it felt incredibly uncomfortable, but I was like, no, we gotta seek out like energy. I'm okay. Sure there's more different types of open mics that really are about that welcoming community, you know? I'm not going to name these early ones, you know, because everybody tries to do their best they can. But eventually it led to, like, me going to this spot called Mama's Hot Tamales.
Hey, MacArthur Park.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they used to have a bookstore right next door. Mm. They were connected. I think it was like a joint.
Mama's used to be a bigger deal than it is now.
Yeah. Shout out, Mama's Hot Tamales. But yeah, so there was a bookstore there, and there was this super dope collective of female identifying breakdancers.
Oh right.
Yeah, and so they hosted this open mic. So I started going to that one, and it was super dope, man. They would like break dance in the middle, and it felt closer to what I was looking for. Closer
that
to
same vibe.
Yeah,
this is way back when you could still find dead bodies in the.
Lake. Yeah, bro. Like you could still it was dangerous to walk there.
Yeah,
like you know the I think the red line was already up.
Yeah.
So you could ride the red line there, but like MacArthur Park. Just walking from the red line to Mama's Hot Tamales was...
That's like less than a block.
Yeah. And you get hit up for micas.
Yeah.
And you get hit up for favors and all kinds of stuff. But it was, but it was worth it. We would go and share, and it was a beautiful little community. And I ended up meeting a friend there. She wasn't my friend at the time, but I met this woman who was also there for the open mic. And I'm all talkative and friendly. So I'm like, how you doing? You know, what's going on? Oh, so exciting. You know, you're this poet. Amazing. You know, and then she started talking. But there was a little bit of a feeling of, like, you know, that same defensiveness. Like, hey, let me make sure which is completely fine now because now I recognize it. And like, oh, this is, you know, it's okay. We can, you know, move past this. So anyway, I was like, you know, she's like, yeah, I just moved here from New York. I'm looking for a... You know, I was looking for work, and I said, I'm looking for work, too. I found all of these different after-school programs, because she also works with youth. So I said, let me get your email, and I'll send you all kinds of them. So I sent her all kinds of them, and we ended up becoming friends. And then she told me about open mic. She's like, yo, have you been to 33 and the Third Bookstore? I said, no. She's like, over there on MacArthur Park. Is it MacArthur Park? It's like Silver Lake, MacArthur Park. It's on like Alvarado and...
Like in that Echo Park ambiguous area, yeah.
Yeah, so
Filipino townish.
Yeah, it's by that. Yeah, I think you know where it is. But I feel bad for not knowing exactly where it was. But it was this revolutionary bookstore that just sold a lot of novels and instructional manuals, I guess, for revolution. And she said, go there... look for Mike the Poet.
Hey.
And she's like, I said, how am I going to find him? She's like, he'll probably be outside. He's the guy with the bluest deep eyes, sky eyes. So I end up going, bro. I get off the bus and I'm looking at everybody in their eyes. I'm like, who got the bluest eyes here? And then Mike's outside sitting there with a notebook. And he's like, yo, what's up? And I introduce myself and he puts me on the list. And I go in and I do a poem. And that community was so warm, bro. So like welcoming, inviting, and so I just kept going to that open mic.
Mm.
At the same time, I had a whole bunch of friends that I had made. So I went to LACC by accident. I was going to Melrose to buy some comic books.
All right,
and I got on the wrong bus, the short bus. So it led me off by the Braille Institute. So I said, let me walk around here. And I walk around like, whoa, there's a college behind this thing.
Yeah.
And I met this one Latino dude, and he was like, hey, what you doing, man? He's like, you interested in school? Come on, let's get you signed up. So he just signed me up for school. And then I was a student at LACC. But
right.
I met all kinds of friends there, and eventually...
Help that guy meet his quota.
Yeah, exactly. I met all kinds of people there, and we ended up... a lot of them lived in South Pasadena. And a lot of them were artists and poets. So we ended up at the same time, like, creating this little collective called the Lost Marbles Collective.
Mm.
And we did all kinds of art shows out there in, like, we would convert an auto shop garage or an empty house into, like, an art space.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it was a really fun time.
Ahead of y'all's time. Yeah. Like, that's something people are doing now.
Exactly, exactly. And we were just, like, you know, we were just having fun, drinking, writing, and said, let's make something for the community. Let's do it, you know?
Yeah.
So we did about 4 or 5 shows. But I was doing that at the same time as this was happening. And Mike kept inviting me places. Like, yo, there's this other open mic. Let's go. Because he hosts, y'all, Mike the Poet in the early 2000s.
Shout out to Mike.
Was it not even the late 2000s to, like, the 2010s? Like,
I caught him a few times.
Bro,
yeah.
Everywhere. He hosted everywhere back then. And he would always invite. And then he started inviting me to, like, college gigs. And from meeting him, I met my other community, which I adored, you know, this artist community. I met my friend Sarah Cruz, who was an amazing poet, songstress. You know, I met Black Spinach, who I had mentioned. And so just great people that I was building with and collaborating with.
Yeah, growing in this community that you didn't know was there.
Exactly, exactly. And I was like, this is what community can be like. Yeah, so eventually that got me an opportunity to go to Africa.
No way.
Yeah. So I met in that open mic circuit, we met this man named Akila Shirelles, who's a good friend, and he was responsible for the Watts Peace Treaty in 1992, him and his brother. So he came at it with this idea because he saw Sarah and I perform a few times, and he enjoyed our poetry, and he liked that it was kind of on the spiritual side and the community healing. And so he invited us to interview to be lead advocates for this thing he was starting, which was a Truth and Restorative Justice Commission.
Oh, wow.
Right? And it was called the Reverence Project. And so we interviewed. It was a really relaxed interview, bro. We were just chilling in, like, his sacred space. He had this room that was built up for, like, for his prayer, you know, so we were in there, and there may have been, like, you know, a little smoke or something, but at the end of it, we became advocates and got to go to South Africa and meet with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Wow.
And learn about restorative justice on a really deep level, brother, which is a whole nother story. I won't say the whole thing
now.
Yeah,
that's deep.
But it was a phenomenal experience, and at the same time, I feel like I'm talking a lot and fast.
Dude, you're the guest. I'm just here to, you know, facilitate.
Time is a strange thing, right? That's why I love the indigenous idea of time, where it's not linear, where it's just, it comes in when it's relevant to the story.
Yeah.
You know? But I was, at that same time, while I went to Africa, or when I got that opportunity, I was working with the Reverence Project, I was the program coordinator at the Achuchas. Centro Cultural.
Shout out. Yeah,
still there. Yeah. Still doing it. And I got to be mentored by both Luis Rodriguez and Trini Rodriguez, which
is
phenomenal. Like, they're just amazing people, really, really. And I got to see a vision of what offering a gift can be on that level. But yeah, so I was there and I was experiencing a lot of ritual with them. I got to do Sweat Lodge and all kinds of amazing stuff with that. And at the same time, got to learn about restorative justice on that end in South Africa. Man. And came back. And
That's a life-changing experience right there.
Most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, I met a man who was convicted of murder. So I met this... I'm going to tell this shortly.
Go for it.
There's this woman named Linda Beale, and her daughter was murdered out there during apartheid. Her daughter was out there, and she was trying to do work with communities and the townships. And when shit hit the fan, you know, and stuff started getting really complicated out there, like, people were just seeing white, and they were like, that's the enemy, that's the oppressor. And so she got caught up in the township and ended up, her daughter got caught in the township and ended up getting murdered.
Damn.
And so we got to hear this story from Linda Beale here before we left to Africa. And she told us about participating in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So those guys got arrested. They did time, maybe think about 6 years. And then this Truth and Reconciliation Commission came up, and they got the opportunity to, you know, ask for amnesty. And so she flew back there And she told them, you know, you took my daughter from me, but you silenced her voice. I want to make sure no one's voice is ever silenced again. So not only do I grant you amnesty, but I forgive you.
Damn.
And I started crying when I heard that, bro. It's the biggest thing I've ever heard, you know, because I'm like, that happened, you know, at that time, I was like, that happened to my family. Like, I don't know if I'd be able to do that.
Yeah.
But she ended up not only, like, forgiving them, she ended up building the Amy Beal Project, you know, which was in her daughter's name, with those two people who had murdered her daughter. And she ended up kind of adopting them like sons.
Damn.
And so I got to meet those two guys out there, and they told me their side a story as well. And it's like, wow, there's so much oppression and so much victimization of all these people. Like, yeah, these are actions not too different from what we see here with our young people or like these street gangs, right? Like, these acts of aggression are really people looking to communicate something deep burning inside of them, and we don't get the opportunity to. So, I mean, I learned so much, brother. I was humbled so much being out there. And, it was amazing, and it definitely influences the work that I do in the world.
Oh, man, I can see that now, man. Because, I mean, one of my questions was, going to be how what you're doing now, right, and how we came to know each other, where you're holding space for other folks, and now in your day job, right, holding space for young folks, to continuing that mentorship, and being in that supportive role of like, you're going through it, and it looks like the way you're going through it to you, but, you know, I went through it the same way in my own way, right? So we can connect and build on that. But I did want to talk about a little bit about, you know, you building space here in Bull Heights, too, when you hosted open mics at Corazón del Pueblo back in the day.
Yeah, that was a, fun, interesting time.
It was also the time, and if anybody's listened to the show, they know that I love talking about all the good times we had at Tenno Sushi.
Oh, man. Shout out to Tenno Sushi. I was a karaoke host there.
Yeah, if you were there.
You were there, you know. It was good times.
Getting kicked out at 2 a.m. Y'all got to leave.
$1 pint, $5 pitchers. It was insane, and it was an amazing, beautiful time.
Oh, my God.
So I guess, you know, after all of this stuff, I sort of I moved over here to First Street, off of First and like Breed.
Oh shit! Yeah.
Yeah. So I moved on this side of Boyle Heights, which is kind of unofficially the like arts district, but it wasn't when I moved here.
It was just in the plans.
Yeah, it was in the plans, and so, you know, I was here, and I was. I had heard about this open mic going on what's the Love Hate? Is it, no, not Love Hate. It's called the bar at the corner with the mariachi on it.
Oh, Eastside Love.
Eastside Love.
So once upon a time when Eastside Love was barely opening, and to you know, kind of speak to that unofficial art district crowd, the space, the bar on Sundays would host open mics.
Yeah. It was Willie Aron.
Yeah.
Would host that open mic. So we I ended up going there. And it was fun, man. It was
before that bar blew up? Hell yeah.
It was so fun. Cause it was just locals. You know, it was just like local artists, local activists, all up in the bar, and
everybody that's 21 and over.
Yeah, exactly. and so it was a lot of fun. But I performed there a few times, and I ended up meeting people like Johnny DeLuna. Mm-hmm. Did we meet there?
Yeah,
I met you there, right? Yeah. Abel Salas and
I was at Eastside Love once. I stopped going once they wouldn't let me in with shorts.
Yeah, I had to have a collared shirt. I was done. I was like, nope. It's like, I have collared shirts, but I'm not gonna wear it because you're telling me to wear it. It was a lot of fun, and we met people there. And then Abel ended up having this space called Casa. No, it was called
Brooklyn and Boyle.
Brooklyn and Boyle.
It was named after the magazine he's put out. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we went there a few times, and I think, he couldn't sustain it on his own anymore. So so some people were invited to like a sustainer meeting to try to keep the space going, And I think originally there was like a Josefina Lopez. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, and then
folks, because they were right next door with Casa.
Yeah, exactly. And Ileana, Paco and Leon and Skyra.
Yeah, yeah.
All who I've never met before, never seen in, you know, in the hood. So it was kind of exciting. Like, I was like, ooh, people are coming out to try to support. This is exciting. And they were going to have like a sort of fundraiser. So they did. They had a fundraiser and they had a poetry night. And then I remember the regulars, because I think Abel had a few poetry nights. And I remember the regulars who used to go to Brooklyn and Boyle were really angry because they were being charged to get in.
Yeah, I remember. that was the beef.
Yeah, how dare you charge me to get in? And
like, bro, I'm one of the performers. Why are you charging me to get in?
Yeah, exactly.
Miscommunication.
Yeah, but I ended up going in there and rocking some poetry. And the sustainers really felt what we were offering. So they asked myself, Johnny DeLuna, and Christy Lovich to, like, if we would host it, like, mm-hmm. we would do a weekly. Mm-hmm. And so we said, yeah, you know, we're down to do this, you know, but it's a lot of work, you know. But we did, and it ended up being called Flowers of Fire, which I think was named after one of Christy's poems.
I think so. I can't confirm right now.
Yeah, I think it was named after one of her poems. But they didn't know. I mean, I know they didn't really know who I was up to that point. And they're like, oh, he's a poet. He you know, and he's kind of like chatty and you know, gift of gab or whatever. But they didn't know I had been doing it for years. So I'd been cultivating all these communities.
In other spaces.
And I was really excited, truthfully, to be able to bring an open mic to my neighborhood, right? Because I was like, this is, if something like this would have been here when I was a young person, you know, my life would have had a different trajectory, you know, or maybe sooner, right? I would have started.
Yeah, what if, yeah.
But it was an opportunity to offer that to the community and to young people who can have it now, you know? So we did it, and there were some beautiful nights, man.
Oh, man, packed houses. I remember, like, overflow, everybody listening from the outside.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it was so great. I mean, just thinking back, I'm getting a little bit of chills. Always my intention is to start something to help build the foundation and then pass it on, right? I'm like, although I love being on the mic and I love being on the stage, it's never only about me, you know? So I was like, how do we build this into something that can be inherited, you know? So we did it for about a year. I think Johnny and Christy did it for about 6 months, mm-hmm. and then they stepped away because it was too much for them, responsibility, because they had other things going on. And then so I was like the solo host for a while, and I was bringing, it was great because like we were featuring people from the neighborhood, but I was able to bring like a Mike the Poet in, you know, like a best kept all the way from Pomona, good, you know,
featured poets,
and it was great to give that cross exposure to everybody. Eventually, you know, it got a momentum of its own, and I stepped down. I mean, you know, I got to bring people into co-host, which was fun. I think I co-hosted a few times with Sid Lalik. Shout out to Sid Lalik, one of my homies. It was magical, man. It felt like we were taking back a space.
Yeah. You know,
like we're planting a garden. We were like sowing seeds and like beautiful flowers were growing. You know?
Definitely, you know, definitely appreciate it now more than ever, right? That I was part of that space, that I was there to share in community. It wasn't always like smooth sailings, but you know, we all figured it out within ourselves. And like, I think like most people can understand, right? When you run a self-sustaining space where you're intentional about not being a nonprofit and who is funding you and who you take money from, that in itself is the struggle and ultimately like the nail in the coffin, right? That how long can you keep this going without, you know, all these complicated forms of revenue, and how long can the community keep it sustained?
Yeah, and I mean, there's just so many personalities and so many cooks in that kitchen, you know? And I didn't always agree with everything that happened there, but people are in their own growth process,
you know?
And there's, you know, there's...
It's a great way to put it. Too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, I hope they're all well now. I think everyone was part of something really special and beautiful. And I think really that space or that intention sort of set off a chain reaction, because I think other things were born.
Oh, yeah.
From that space.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
Yeah. But it was definitely the heart of the arts movement at that time.
Yeah. So to skip forward a little bit, now you're working with Street Poets, Inc. How did, first of all, like, can you explain it to folks, you know, what y'all do, what it is, and then how you got involved with it?
Yeah, so Street Poets is a nonprofit organization. It's been around for about 25 years. That started out in the probation camps with this man named Chris Henriksen, and eventually evolved into working, you know, with... So it started with prevention work. Intervention work, and then eventually evolved into prevention work. Mm, so it started offering workshops in schools, and it really uses poetry as a tool for transformation. That's the intention of it, where it's like, let's strip away everything at first, all the rules of poetry, and just give people permission to speak, you know? And then later you can add all that stuff in, but what's most important is like that all of us are wounded, but that there's a gift in that wound. And if we learn how to navigate it with grace, right, and respect, that we can turn that narrative that kind of weighs us down, that narrative of pain and trauma and the things that we've been through.
The cycles we're stuck in,
Like we turn that into a chapter of the book that we're writing as opposed to the entire story. So that's in a nutshell some of the work that Street Poets does, and which was really beautiful because that's the work that I was doing as well when I met them. You know, I was offering workshops. I remember offering workshops in like the side of the freeway, right? That little grassy area. Like I would take young people with me and we'd write together. But yeah, so I met Street Poets a few times actually. I once performed in a juvenile hall, and it was myself, and then Street Poets had a little crew, and then it was Ozo Madley.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so we all performed for these young people, and I met them there first, and then I met Chris again. So I went to this, Louis took me the first time to this men's retreat in the middle of Mendocino County, so it was like 100 men in the middle of the forest. It was intense, but I had met Chris there as well, and he told me, oh, yeah, man, bust up, like, you know, I remember you.
And then keep running into each other in the same circles.
Yeah, so eventually I got, you know, a few years later, I got hired on as a teaching artist, and then eventually I, you know, I rose in the ranks, and I'm like, I'm a teaching artist and director of school and community programming, and I design a lot of the curriculum and, you know, stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's good. It's good work. It's a good organization. It attracts good people. And like all, you know, it has its
limitations being a nonprofit.
Yeah. You know, but we'll, you know, hopefully it continue. I mean, I'm on this idea. It's like either it's going to get better or it's going to become the soil for better things to grow. You know, like that's all things, you know. I think that's what Corazon was, right?
It's looking at that differently. Because in the moment, right, we're in that space, we're seeing it one way, and it's only an afterthought sometimes that we can, you know, realize what other different angles and aspects of it we were participating in that we weren't seeing at the time.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. But yeah, it's been really amazing. I've taught in most of the schools in Los Angeles. Most of the probation camps in Los Angeles, which are thankfully starting to close down because we're starting to see that was never the answer, that you know, people need people to heal.
Yeah, it can't just be punitive and lock kids away.
Exactly. So that's, but because of that, I got to work in a lot of these places. I also got to travel and work abroad, you know, so I've taught in the UK, I've taught in, you know.
Yeah, oh man, that shit trips me out. It's like, well, you got projects in England?
Yeah, it's true, man.
Top boy over here.
Yeah, they got projects everywhere, bro.
I was like, why do your projects look better than ours?
Yeah, exactly. Well, dude, you should don't ask about the prison system in Sweden, bro. It's like a 5-star hotel.
Oh, yeah. We got. Yeah.
But it's because they view people differently. You know?
Different, cultures.
Yeah, so there's more of an investment to like rehabilitate, you know, or reimagine rather. But yeah, I've got to, you know, I've done workshops in the forests of Sweden, you know, and South America, all, you know, a few places in Europe and Africa. So like, I mean, the beautiful part is like, I feel like I'm answering a calling, you know? So like street poets is phenomenal, but it's a relationship and a collaboration, right?
In
so,
that journey.
Yeah. You know, and it's been a beautiful experience, you know, and it continues to be. And I'm like, wow, what's next, you know? Because we're all truthfully elders in training, you know? So it's like we can't stay stagnant. You know, we have to learn as much as we can.
Yeah.
How do I amplify my gift to offer to more people, you know?
Yeah, dude. And I mean, it's very heavy work you do, working with youth, right? Working with youth in any capacity, but then working with youth that are really going through it, right? In difficult situations, and in the same situation we were at one point, in systems that are failing us and just allowing us to do wrong things because we have no direction, right? And it's not maybe until later on in life that we find that direction, but still, you know the work you and other folks do is just, we need more of that, right? We need to help the youth to figure out their own stuff in their own way. And any way that can be facilitated through poetry, arts, you know, that's always like a fucking positive space is something that I'm always down for.
Yeah, brother, and thank you for saying that. I mean, it's so necessary. Like, the beautiful part is that the healing that I get to experience as well. Mm. You know, like, it's never just like, I don't have this attitude where I go in and teach stuff, right? Oh, I'm gonna come in and teach you guys something. I'm like, no, this has always been an exchange. You know, there's a reason why we've been brought into each other's lives at this moment. It's because both of us have something to learn from each other. Mm. You know, whether you're 6 or 60, you know, there's potential there. If you see the person for what they are, this constant work in progress.
Yeah, like you said, you know, opening up the space to giving folks an avenue to just vent.
Yeah, you know, to speak their story, their truth, you know, and hold space and not judge it or not try to fix it, right?
Yeah,
but
just
allow it to be and allow them to breathe.
Yeah, because I mean, I know it's very intimidating, right? To even be in a situation like this where you have a microphone in front of you, you're speaking to an audience, even though we don't see it, and then, but you being in front of open mics and performing, you see people. But then even in those intimate situations, right, when y'all are working with the youth and maybe it's like 10 of y'all and it's a small group, but that 10 people can feel like 10,000 when you're like trying to be vulnerable.
Most definitely, you know, and to encourage that vulnerability is really challenging because like young people were right. And this is the amazing part is like they're ready. Mm. They're ready to get this stuff out of them, you know. So I'll go in with a simple starter line like, if you knew me, you would know, you know, and they will pour out everything.
It's just like, whoosh.
You know, and I remember this one instance where I went into this school on the south side, and we did this poem, and the same thing, we put, I know a boy who, I know a girl who, I know a person who, right? We put those three starter lines on the board after this poem that we shared, and all of them just broke open, right? And they're all crying, and like, or some of them were crying, but they're like talking about some really deep stuff to them. We come back the following week and they recoil, which is expected, right? Because they're like, ooh, I was vulnerable. I'm not used to that.
I didn't see that one coming. Yeah.
So they were all quiet. And then I was like, y'all good? Do we just need to sit together today? And they're like, this one young person, they were like, damn. And I looked at her and I said, why you always got to come in here and make us cry and shit, right? And I said, me? Like, make you cry? I don't have that power. You know, all I did was come up and put these three words, these three sentences, starter lines on the board. I'm like, you wrote what you wrote because it was alive in you. So what's going on in you? What needs to be seen? What needs to be heard in you that's bringing that? And there ain't nothing wrong with crying, right? Tears are holy water. They're necessary in this world. And, you know, so it's like to be able to meet them and to hold whatever comes into the room, you know, is key, you know? And also, I have to go in knowing that I don't know anything, you know, that I'm just offering something and that that I can't go in with ego or expectation, right? Like, their growth and their healing is going to look like what it looks like to them. I don't know their experience. you know, but I can celebrate their leaps and bounds no matter how, what size they are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Damn, man. Why are you making us cry? Yeah, the kind of energy you would expect from youth.
Oh, they're great, bro. And this is the great part is like, young people can smell inauthenticity.
Of course.
So you go in, like, this is why people have so much trouble sometimes teaching. It's like, because you ain't being real. Like, go in there and be you. Tell your story. Like, are you doing the work you're asking them to do? Because if you're not, they're going to know. Mm-hmm. And they're going to call you on it every single time.
That's why I don't get too butthurt when they don't laugh at my Simpsons jokes.
me either, bro.
That's just a gap in the cultural space there.
Yeah, that's not fun, feeling that aging when you use a reference and they're like, who's that? Bro, I did a Lauryn Hill reference the other day.
Oh.
Nobody got it.
They'll get it soon.
Yeah, hopefully. They need good music in their life.
All right, so, yeah, we're reaching our time. Where can folks find you? Where do you have any new projects coming up? Anything you want to talk about and share with folks?
Yeah, most of my, you can find me at Bus Stop Profit, most of it on Instagram, Facebook, my website that is always in the works, but it's up. Yeah, you can find me there. You can contact me there. LinkedIn, Francisco Escamilla or Frank Escamilla.
Oh, LinkedIn, yeah. People are on it now.
I'm trying to be better at that.
That shit's annoying as fuck.
It is. It is. But, you know, I'm trying to utilize it to expand. But I'm doing a lot, brothers. Creatively, I have a couple children's books coming out that I wrote. Yeah, I'm excited about that. So that hopefully will be out by Christmas.
Nice. I got a bunch of nieces and nephews that need books.
Oh, I'm excited, bro. I'm excited to see that in their hands, you know? Like, that would be amazing. I got my forever... Like, long, it's taking forever, my poetry book. I'm pushing to get out also by the end of the year.
Hey.
So that's happening. Creatively, I'm writing a horror movie right now, which is really exciting.
What's the theme of the movie?
Gentrification.
All right. Wait, what movie did I see that was a bunch of... Candyman. Oh, that was a good one. The first one's the new one
that
just came out.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, you love it. Yeah? It has gentrification as violence undertones.
Okay. Yeah, I'm excited. It's I want to tell, like, I'm like, how do we use these themes that have been used over and over again, but to tell our own stories? With our own myths, with our own, you know.
Cholos fighting vampires.
Exactly. Hey, I knew a cholo named El Vampiro, so.
Hey.
There you go. and then also, I mean, I do this work, you know, with street poets, but I also offer this work, you know, individually on my own. So I do, if anybody's interested, you got an org, you got, you know.
Educators.
Educators, a company. Like, I go in and do community building workshops. I do poetry workshops. Especially now that the pandemic's over, people need to connect, and I have this, I've been blessed with this ability to be that bridge to help people connect quickly. So I got tons of workshops that are being offered online or in person. So if you're interested, hit me up. And yeah, bro, I feel like life has been so good, you know, and I've done so much. And truthfully, I feel like y'all ain't seen nothing yet, like. I'm gonna be rocking this magic till I'm not here no more, you know.
Yeah, man, gotta keep it going. That's beautiful. Yeah, I'm definitely excited for you to put out your book, both the adult version and the children's version.
Yeah, there's one more I want to. I mean, I'm trying to do. Truthfully, Eric, I want to do my own Where the Sidewalk Ends. You know, I have a bunch of you know children's rhymes as well. So hopefully there'll be a poetry book. A couple poetry books soon, one being The World According to Bus Stop Profit.
Hell yeah, man. You know? I'm looking forward to that community space when you review those books.
Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Doing some live readings. But yeah, follow him on IG, Bus Stop Profit, all one word, no capital letters or anything. And yeah, man, thank you again for making the time and coming through.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you for the invitation, brother. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, cool. So thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been Orale Ball Heights. We'll catch you on the next one.